This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning, or very good morning. This is Belinda Cora coming to you live from the ABC Bureau in Port Moresby, Papua New Guinea, to host this morning's Pacific Beat Show here on Radio Australia. Thank you for joining me as we also mark the first day of a new month and just 54 days away from PNG's 50th Independence Anniversary celebrations. Pacific Beat comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Today on the show, health professionals call for greater support as sexually transmitted infections skyrocket among farm workers.
When we looked at it, the rates of things like chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis seem to be higher than the Australian population.
Also, police in PNG issue warrants for those accused of a sorcery-related murder after the suspects were released from custody. And we head to New Zealand for the first Vanuatu Bislama Language Week. All that and more still ahead. Let's get started. But first, we start in Fiji, where the High Court has found 9 men guilty of various charges stemming from the country's biggest drug bust. They were charged after 4 tons of methamphetamines were found in the tourist town of Nandi last year. Our reporter in Fiji, Lide Movono, was at the courthouse as the judge handed out his verdict.
The trial revealed the scale and sophistication of drug cartels operating in the Pacific, with evidence showing super yachts, satellite phones and encrypted apps were used to move over 4 tons of methamphetamines into the Pacific. Justice Aruna Alutke said the case exposed serious vulnerabilities in Fiji's border control and cited alarming evidence of complicity from officers within the Narcotics Bureau. Despite this, he praised Fijian law enforcement for their ability to prosecute complex transnational crime, with prosecutors securing convictions on 10 of the 12 charges laid. In his ruling, Justice Alutke singled out accused Justin Ho as being the ringleader of the importation operation. He rejected Ho's defense of duress, saying that if he truly feared for his life, he had ample opportunity to seek police protection. All 9 convicts will be sentenced next month. The case, which began in January of 2024, marks a turning point in Fiji's fight against organized drug trafficking.
Now, this trial was regarded in Fiji as a test for the justice system and its ability to confront cases involving transnational drug trade allegations. The High Court judge said the case exposed serious vulnerabilities in Fiji's border control, and Pacific security expert Dr. Jose Sousa Santos warns that the large players in this drug trade haven't been found and still pose a risk.
It's good to see that the trial proceeded so quickly and that the judge did not accept any of the excuses given by the defendants. But by the same token, I would have liked to have seen more emphasis put into getting a clearer picture on who the other players are. And I think that's very important. There's several layers here. In Fiji, we need to identify who was involved in facilitating these activities, within law enforcement, within customs, and within the commercial sector as well. It seems that we have, in Fiji, they've grabbed the easier targets, and maybe a bit more investigating and mapping a bit further would have helped even from a national perspective on who could have been investigated and charged. When we look at from an international perspective, and this is where the real threat and these are the drivers of the smuggling of methamphetamines through Fiji. Who are the cartels involved? That is an issue because that actual criminal infrastructure, is still in place. So we've only taken away a very small, and when you actually think about it, unimportant cog in this machine. The main two parts, which is from the source point to delivery point. So the key players who's paying for it and who's making money from it and who are actually making moving the drugs through have not been touched, and have not been mapped. So the risk is still there. Will they move these drugs to Fiji again, or will they move to different areas of the Pacific, different Pacific Island countries? That is an unknown.
On that, the judge highlighted that there were serious vulnerabilities in Fiji's border force control and pointed to, quote, alarming evidence that officers from the Office of Narcotics Bureau were complicit. Do you think there is going to be immense pressure on Fiji police to investigate this, with the spotlight of this trial now exposing this?
Definitely. This is of course, it was only recently that you also had the 5 kilos seized in Nandi, where officers of the counter-narcotics, two officers from the counter-narcotics bureau and the head of customs intelligence were involved in this importation of methamphetamines from the east coast of Africa to Fiji. So the red flags are definitely there. I think the issue here is who's going to investigate the counter-narcotics bureau, who's going to investigate customs. Does Fiji have an agency which is tasked with, I mean, apart from FICAC, but has the capacity to investigate these agencies independently and be able to push for prosecution?
This trial was seen as a test for how Fiji would tackle transnational crime, with the justice finding several of the accused guilty, including Justin Ho, who he described as the key figure and main beneficiary of the operation. How significant is this result in the context of how Fiji is tackling transnational crime?
It's very significant. And I think this is a first step in actually showing the region on how being able to strengthen your legislation and updating your legislation enables you to prosecute criminals and other players in this field to the full extent of the law. Where in other Pacific Island states currently, legislation is outdated and not contextual to the current criminal landscape.
Are there any countries in particular that you would pinpoint as perhaps being able to learn from what they've seen happen in Fiji?
Definitely Samoa, Solomon Islands. I think especially Samoa at the moment is it's still working with legislation dating back to the 60s. I think over the past few years, in the last seizure where we had several tons of methamphetamines, cocaine, which was seized in Port Moresby, and where prosecution of the perpetrator was not be able to proceed due to the legislation. More attention has been put on how to update and how to change legislation to enable this kind of prosecutions. So I think at the moment, especially, as you're starting to see the rise of methamphetamine usage, the movement of both methamphetamines, cocaine and weapons through Samoa, Samoa should be a country which should be moving on updating its legislation as quickly as possible.
What message do you think this trial sends to those involved in the movement of meth and transnational crime in Fiji as a hub, but then in the wider Pacific as well?
I think there's two messages. A positive message and a negative message. The positive message is that Fiji will arrest and prosecute perpetrators involved in these kind of illegal activities of drug trafficking, and other transnational criminal activities in the region. But I think the negative here is the perception to the larger players, to the cartels, to the syndicates in Australia, New Zealand, to the triads coming from China or other syndicates from Southeast Asia, is that it's the smaller players who will get arrested, prosecuted, and then sentenced, while they still remain in a protective bubble. And I think that is the bad message that's coming out of this, is that there's been no real targeting or high-level targeting of these other entities.
That was Associate Professor at the University of Canterbury's Pacific Regional Security Hub, Jose Sousa Santos, speaking there to our reporter, Jordan Fennell.
In the Fale is a music show on ABC Radio Australia, hosted by me, Paola Tukefu. I'll be spinning my favourite tunes from dancehall to disco, calypso to country, reggae to roots, and hip-hop to house music, from across the eras to keep the kids and the aunties happy. If it has a pumping groove, I'll be bringing it to you to bump you into the weekend.
In the Fale, Friday afternoons at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Health professionals are calling for greater support to deliver information and services to PALM scheme workers as rates of sexual transmitted infections skyrocket. It follows a unique study which hopes to guide potential screening programs for Pacific workers in Australia. Lucy Cooper has this report.
Before Fijians can leave their country for a stint working in Australia under the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility or PALM scheme, they first must meet someone like Sarah.
For PALM scheme workers, we do awareness first on sexual and reproductive health, and it ranges from STIs, HIV, to cervical cancer, to prostate cancer, to HIV, and also family planning.
Sarah Ratu is the program leader at the Reproductive and Family Health Association of Fiji.
We are a non-governmental organization. We are a part of the International Planned Parenthood Federation. We provide information and services on sexual health.
When PALM scheme workers attend pre-departure meetings, a litany of topics are covered, including sexual health. This is when Sarah comes in. But delivering the information effectively can be difficult.
As much as we would love to do a lot of things, we have our time slots. So it's not just us doing the session. There's a lot of other organizations and institutions providing information. So max, we have about 2 hours, and it really depends how many people are coming in for testing. Because sometimes you have more than 100 people. Sometimes it's less than 10 people, so it really depends on the time that we have. But mostly it's on presentations, and on the side we have discussions.
Once workers arrive in Australia, education and services are provided to by different organisations and health departments based on the state they're in. In North Queensland, Dr Michaela Seymour is a public health medical officer at the Townsville Public Health Unit. After a tip-off from a GP, she started looking into a potential STI breakout amongst Solomon Islander PALM scheme workers.
We were concerned because when we looked at it, the rates of things like chlamydia, gonorrhea and syphilis seemed to be higher than the Australian population. So we were worried that there might be an outbreak. So we just felt there was a responsibility to, one, look after the health of these people who are helping our farmers, but two, also to make sure that there wasn't a risk of STI spreading in the local community.
Working with the Solomon Islands Department of Health, Dr. Seymour embarked on a study to gather more information about the cohort.
In terms of what we learnt and what we found, there was quite concerning rates of something called treponemal infection. So that's a bacterial infection that can cause both syphilis and yours. So both of these are bacterial conditions that can lead to complications that can be quite serious later in life, but also for pregnant women can cause issues for unborn babies. So it's really something that we need to get on top of. We were also concerned by the high rates of chlamydia. So about 30% of people we tested had infectious chlamydia. And again, that can cause things like infertility in both men and women and can cause issues for newborn babies. So something that definitely needed to be treated.
Dr. Seymour said her team was overwhelmed by the demand. Often they have about 30 to 40% of a community turning out to get support. But in this PALM cohort, 91% wanted to engage.
It's quite a stigmatising issue a lot of the time. So I guess we thought, we weren't sure what our participation rate would be. Honestly, we thought if we got 10%, it would be a success. The fact that it was people were so engaged with their health and so keen to learn more, get information, increase their health literacy, and sort of took this really proactive approach was incredibly encouraging. And I think that suggests to us that there's probably a lot of unmet demand for healthcare in the PALM community.
The study told Dr. Seymour that gaps in knowledge around sexual health need to be addressed.
There was a lot of services that were keen to offer education and information, but it's that linkage with health access. We've got to remember a lot of these workers are in rural and regional areas where access to healthcare for everyone is difficult. And then all of a sudden you add on, you know, English as a second language, social and cultural barriers, maybe not having the best understanding of Medicare and how Australian health works. It's just more and more barriers mounting up.
One such service is Health in My Language, provided by TRU, formerly known as Family Planning Queensland. Sare Amatulla helped deliver the program to Palm Scheme workers, travelling to farms to deliver health education sessions in language.
We've seen that's been very effective because language is a barrier as well. It's also building confidence in the seasonal workers to say, hey, if you're experiencing this, here's where you can go.
Miss Amatulla is now the CEO and director of Nikawa Limited, a not-for-profit organisation which offers holistic and culturally responsive services for Pacifica community living in Queensland.
This topic of sexual and reproductive health isn't spoken in households back in the Pacific. It's not even taught in schools as well. So really, it's a collaborative effort in the Pacific, in Australia, on how we can deliver this information pre-departure so that there is knowledge there, there is an understanding there of what to expect.
She'd like to see greater collaboration between organisations to offer best practice services.
One size fits all health education doesn't work. So to be effective, we need holistic, culturally grounded care that addresses not just physical health, but emotional, mental and spiritual well-being. Back in the Pacific, spiritual well-being is such a huge way of living. And that's something that's missing when they're here, away from family, creating safe, supportive environments where workers are not socially isolated also plays a huge role. Community-led education, peer support and trusted cultural brokers can make a real difference in improving engagement and reducing STI rates.
Back in Fiji, Sarah Ratu said fear and ignorance prevent workers getting the help they need. To tackle this, she'd like to have greater access to workers to offer a more tailored service before they depart.
It would have been good to discuss again with National Employment Centre to identify areas where these seasonal workers are coming from, you know, like have a targeted approach, because that's the only time we can get them during the pre-departure. But what about, you know, like in their communities? Even though we provide information during the pre-departure sessions, but it's just for 2 hours and then they're leaving the next day or the next 2 days.
Dr. Michaela Seymour wants to see more safe spaces created to have at times difficult conversations about sexual and reproductive health.
We were really lucky that in the group we also had someone who sort of was a pastor back home and was performing that pastoral role here in Australia as well, although just one of the workers. Trying to encourage that no-blame culture. This is about your health. It's not about your marriage. You know, everyone just needs to get healthy and get their health on track.
Lucy Cooper with that report.
Kick off your Sunday with Kuntamari Crofts on Pacific Sundays, right here on ABC Radio Australia. Pacific Sundays is a laid-back weekly wrap of all things Pacific, from news, sport and entertainment to the best island music vibes. So whether you're chilling out, heading off to church or catching up with family, be entertained as you do it with Pacific Sundays. Every Sunday at 6 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm Belinda Cora, coming to you live from Port Moresby. And here to Papua New Guinea, Police Commissioner David Manning has ordered that 8 suspects accused of the torture and murder of a woman accused of practicing sorcery be rearrested after they were released from police custody. The brutal killing of Rosa Yakapus has sparked outrage from PNG's leaders and the public. However, her alleged killers walked free following a court order after the suspects were held for more than 2 weeks without charge. Meanwhile, Commissioner Manning said police were also facing opposition from the community of the victim who were hiding other suspects. Joining me now to speak about the impact, this is Angela Appa, who works assisting victims of sorcery-related violence for COOP Women for Peace. Angela, good morning and welcome to the show. Angela, what was your reaction and that of the communities you work with when you heard that the suspects of Rosa Yakapo's killing had been released?
Good morning, Belinda. Am I right to calling you like this?
Yes, good morning to you, Angela.
Oh, nice talking to you. I'm happy. Well, when I first heard there was a woman being tortured and accused of sorcery, I really felt bad. And due to, you know, in the Highlands, trouble fighting, women were accused of sorcery and they were killed also. So when this was done publicly, it really, you know, brought all the women in tears, and we didn't feel safe to go around in the street. So that's why, and also we felt that we shouldn't be helping other people, because if we give them kai kai to eat or anything like that, they will accuse us of sorcery. And so I felt that it was not fair, and it was inhuman to cause a woman to die. So this is how I felt, and not really good, eh? And also when it was on the news, I felt that that was too much. And also, South can other people around the world will think that, you know, we PNG people are violent and it's unsafe for people to come to PNG. And people did not trust each other, especially in our homes. And some goes, you know, also go against the word of God, eh?
Very true, Angela, and thank you very much for sharing
it
that.
It also trauma to us all women.
Yeah.
Very sorry,
okay,
Angela.
I'm listening.
Yes. Can you explain this kind of message this sends to both survivors and perpetrators of sorcery accusation-related violence across Papua New Guinea?
You come again?
Can you just explain the kind of message this now sends to both survivors and perpetrators of sorcery accusation-related violence across the country?
This message I want to say is that, especially the survivors of sorcery accusation-related violence, is not good, and it's, as I said, we are building hatred. And we don't want to help, is because in our society, we are supposed to be helping each other. But now the survivors feel that it's unsafe for them to help each other. That's for the survivors, and they don't feel safe, as I said. But the perpetrators, the justice is not being, you know, they're not justifying it. The perpetrators are walking free and they are not being judged properly. They are going off. They're walking off. And they need to deal effectively with the law and justice should deal effectively with the perpetrators of violence to sorcery, so that when they see justice being done and given a term, I think other people will learn from that, and they will stop accusing other people for sorcery.
Okay, Angela, we've heard the suspects were released on a technicality because they weren't formally charged. How common is it for cases like this to collapse at the legal or the police level?
I wouldn't know so much as a local person, as an advocate and a trainer in the community on staff education. From my experiences, some are released and the survivors themselves ask for mediation, peace mediation, because if they go through the case, sometimes, you know, they will arrest and send the perpetrator to jail, and they will not feel safe to go back home.
One, leaving the property behind, and they want to make peace so that they will go back to their own area where they will have learned to survive on, even though they have been accused and they have been tortured and they have trauma. But if we repatriate them to other places, they will not be as free to access the land. With the police, sometimes they are being I will not really say, sometimes they may be bribed to release the perpetrator. Secondly, people are afraid. That's why the survivors don't go to court, and then the perpetrator is released maybe after 10, you know, attending the case. Because there are certain things. One, the condition.
Okay.
Two, and then the other one is they don't have money to go and go further cases for, you know, to search the perpetrator. There are certain things, and they are, you know, I think these are the main obstacle that is making the police release the survivors of social aggression-related violence.
Okay, thank you very much, Angela, for that. What changes would you like to see from police and the courts or the government to stop this from happening again?
I would like to see the changes, as I have mentioned, the criminal code that is being printed out or that is being sent out should be mentioned and advocate and teach at the local communities seriously about the law that will have impact on the perpetrators, so that people need information in the village. People need to be educated on the staff. And then there should be a stronger, you know, this law that is being now happening, like code, criminal, staff-related violence, is staff-accusation-related violence is a crime underneath the criminal code. If that should be taken seriously and charged the perpetrator, other people would learn from this.
Okay.
Accusing other people for social-related violence. And that is to be one. That is, one is to do it seriously with the law. Two, we need more advocates. We need more community curriculum. We need more people to be aware of the law. We need to bring the information out in the remote areas, because, and even in the towns, people need to be seriously educated and about SAP, because it's, when we talk about SAP, it's stopping development. It's stopping from, in the eyes of other parts of the world, we are not, you know, it's not safe for them to come in and do their business and all this.
It also stops the development in Papua New Guinea. And we are recognized as bad people. So I seriously have two options. I mean, two suggestions. One, seriously, you know, justice to be taken against these perpetrators. Two, people like KWP and other CSOs on the ground, we are doing this work, should be promoted and should be supported for more advocacy, for more education to be delivered to the people at the village and community.
Okay, thank you very much, Angela, for that. That was Angela Apa, coordinator of COOP Women for Peace, speaking with me there. Stay tuned, because coming up, we'll take a look at what's making headlines around the Pacific. And it's to that time of the morning where we take a look at what's making headlines from around the Pacific. And to do that, I'm joined by producer Kyle Evans. Good morning, Kyle, and how are you? Can you believe that we're actually hosting and presenting in two different countries?
No, I can't, actually, Belinda. It's quite amazing, and I'm sure it's probably, well, I know it's much colder where I am compared to where it is for you. But what I also can't believe is that it's already the first day of August. Where's the year gone?
I know. We had so much fun, didn't we?
The year's not over yet. We've got the 50th anniversary. Well, it's all of a sudden edging up very, very close, isn't it?
I know. Thank goodness for Fridays. We try to forget that a bit. But yes, what an overwhelming week. let's start off this morning, Kyle. High tides caused by this week's tsunami in Russia have damaged the Pacific's largest seaweed exporter. What's happened?
Yeah, well, we're kicking things off with a little bit of a sad story, unfortunately, Belinda. So strong river-like currents have wreaked havoc on seaweed farms in Regina in Chosiel province, which is an area in the Solomon Islands that actually makes up 90% of the country's dried seaweed exports. So this was reported by the Island Sun, who say virtually every farm has been destroyed, according to initial assessments. In fact, one farmer quoted in the story said all but three farms remained out of an initial 200, and that was a figure that was sadly confirmed by the local provincial MP out there. And according to witnesses, the tides were so strong that they virtually rose like a river current. And as they rose and receded, they basically just took everything with it, including the seaweed bundles, which are now just scattered everywhere all over the shoreline. So, yeah, unfortunately, it means a lot of lost livelihoods, particularly in the short term, and our hearts really do go out to them.
Kylie, in rugby, Fiji may be at risk of having their test against Wales, England and Scotland shifted abroad. Why is that?
Yeah, that's right, Belinda. So it's a little bit of a bit of a long story, but I guess long story short is Fiji may soon well become what's known as a Tier 1 rugby team, like Australia and New Zealand. Essentially, that they're put in the upper tier of they're considered one of the best countries in the world at rugby, and that's fair enough because they are. But therefore, as a Tier 1 nation, they need what's called a 25,000 capacity stadium in order to host those big games against other Tier 1 nations. So because they don't have that at the moment, their ability to host international tests against other big nations are all of a sudden compromised. But in this case, the chairman of Fiji Rugby Union, John Sanday, says these limitations might actually work in their favour, at least in the short term, because it's going to force them to host these tests against these nations in neutral venues, which will actually allow them to earn significantly more money in terms of, you know, hard currency such as British pounds and things like that. And that money is just then going to get pumped back into the program. So the FRU board will be evaluating proposals from a number of event managers over the coming weeks to make a decision on which country will host Fiji's matches against those three British nations. So, look, it's no doubt a bit of a short-term blow to Fijian fans, because I'm sure they'd love to see their team play against these big nations in their home country. However, FRU have also said that once they can demonstrate that they can be financially successful as a Tier 1 nation, then they'll look at building a brand new stadium within Fiji that has a 25,000 person capacity, and in fact FRU has already been looking at some land parcels in Singatoa for a potential project down the track.
Well, that's definitely great news for Fiji fans there. To rugby league here in Papua New Guinea, the second season of the Santos Cup National Women's Rugby Competition will kick off this weekend. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, rugby league, a sport quite close to my heart and yours, from what I understand. But all six teams are back for this seven-week competition, which will conclude with the Digicel Cup Grand Final, actually, which will also take place on the same weekend as the PNG's 50th anniversary celebration. So East New Britain Gurriers and the Laysnacks Tigers will kick off the season tomorrow in Rabool. Last year's champs, meanwhile, the Garoka Lahanas, they'll face the Central Debaris on Sunday.
And in the men, who do the PNG Hunters play this week?
Yeah, Belinda, they've got a big game coming up as well, coming up after the bye in the Host Plus Cup. So they've got the Toowoomba Clydesdales at home in Port Moresby. Look, they're at the point of the season now where virtually every game is a must-win for them with three rounds to go. They're currently sitting eighth, tied on wins with ninth place Brisbane. So they want to try and win every game from here on out to ensure that they can get that finals berth in a few weeks' time.
And thank you very much, Kyle. That was producer Kyle Evans with this morning's news wrap.
Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music for the finest in ska, rocksteady, roots, dub, sizzling dancehall, and all the hottest releases from around the Pacific.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Coreni from Sorong Samurai, and you're listening to Island Music.
My name is Tieni from Te Tangi o Te Kara, and you're listening to Island Music.
Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music.
Saturdays, 12 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
And welcome back to Pacific Beat. Bougainville police have condemned the hijacking of former President John Momis and the extortion of MP Willie Massieu as an insult to Bougainville's democratic process. The attacks come just a month out from Bougainville's general election, set to be the second election since the autonomous region for independence from PNG in the 2019 referendum. I spoke with senior NPC journalist Calvin Kasper, who says police have called for peace and order during the campaign period. Can you tell us a little bit more about what had happened yesterday concerning Chief John Momis and I believe the member Willie Massieu? Do you feel police on ground had responded accordingly and that campaigning should be okay in the area of Kono?
The Kono issue that involving former president and senior statesman John Momis is just a picture of what's been going on behind this area in Kono, where there is limited government control and police presence in Kono. This, according to what I've learned, it has been going on for some time, but has never been told or exposed until we had the incident involving former President Momis. Now, the Kono area is a very large area in South Bougainville. It has now been split into two other constituencies to make fair representation of this big constituency. So what I've learned is that candidates are often been intimidated into paying the Mekamui group to carry out their campaigns. And the only time that this incident has come to light is over the weekend when John Momis was himself hijacked and his vehicle taken off him. Police have limited access into Kono, and the Bougainville Police Service is pretty much involved in community policing. So it means no tougher action can be expected in Kono, only that police will be trying their best to solicit support from local leaders. That means clan chiefs, local ward members, women leaders, youth groups, and even leaders of the factions in the Kono area.
Kevin, how unique is this election during this ratification process? How are people reacting and what is the atmosphere like on ground before they finally go to the polls in early September?
The 2025 Bougainville general election is the second general election for Bougainville after the 2019 referendum. So the anticipation from the people is for a government that would continue the push for independence from Papua New Guinea. The Ismail Toroama government has completed its first tenure of 5 years since 2020. It is hoping for a second term in office. There's on the ground, there's strong support for Bougainville to continue the push towards independence. As you would be aware, there's already the suggested timeline of September the 1st, 2027 for independence to be acquired. It's a suggestion at this stage, but a suggestion that would most likely be adopted by the Bougainville Constituent Assembly, which has already been formed and has been meeting since June over the draft Bougainville Constitution, which, if adopted, would effectively mean the Constituent Assembly also setting a time for Bougainville to attain or acquire its independence. The current government now is using its platform for independence and campaigning that it has done much on the political level, and it has to be given a second term to complete whatever it has started. So there is very strong support for the Toroama government continuing a second term to formalize with Papua New Guinea the aspirations of the people of Bougainville for independence.
And that was NBC journalist Kelvin Kaspar on the island of Bougainville speaking with myself earlier on. And this week is the inaugural Vanuatu Bizlama Language Week in Aotearoa, New Zealand. The 2025 theme for Bizlama Week is Tokaboat Clement Tench, Hemiril Mo Yumi Mas Lukautim Life. Talk about climate change, it is real and we must look after life. After 6 years of advocacy, celebrations across the country have been welcomed by proud Ni Vanuatu women, Claire Samuel, a Bachelor of Nursing student at the University of Auckland, spoke to Aggie Tupo on celebrating her homeland and the Bizlama language.
I find it really great, especially being here during the time where it's like actually launching, because I know there's people who've been working behind it, trying to get it into like an official language week in New Zealand, like families who've lived here from Vanuatu. And even though I'm just like a student who's come here like in the last 2 years, I wanted to acknowledge a Vanuatu student here in Auckland University of Technology, Myla Nikita Roberts. She's the one who's doing a lot of the work here for Auckland students in celebrating our Bizlama language week and have like people know that Vanuatu is also like a Pacific island, especially for families here who are from Vanuatu, but they haven't been back for a while. They get to like have that connection at least and share their culture with the people in New Zealand.
I feel like you're still quite brand new to Aotearoa and you grew up in Port Vila, is that correct?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah. Then what caused you to leave home then and move to New Zealand?
I'm actually here studying. So I applied for MFAT scholarship. So it's provided by the Ministry of like Foreign Affairs here in New Zealand. Well, my parents, they studied here as well when they were younger in university. And I felt like I wanted to do that as well, continue on like the legacy, I guess. I just came here to study and I think it's a really good opportunity for me because it's brand new experience. It's very different. And it will benefit a lot of people when I go back home to Vanuatu in the work that I do.
So are you able to tell us specifically what you're studying and what you're hoping to take back to, you know, Vanuatu?
Yeah, I'm studying a Bachelor of Nursing. I'm currently in my second year. And there's a lot of things that I do want to do when I go back. But I think one thing I want to do for sure is just get into the healthcare system and hopefully make an impact to, like, improve it a bit. Right now, it's not really doing its best. It's slowly getting there, but I know I want to do something when I go back.
Claire, you know, since moving to New Zealand, did you find or were you able to easily connect with other Ngāi Vanuatuans?
Yes, we've had quite a few students coming through the scholarship as well. So I've been able to connect with them and stay in touch with them, especially in Auckland. There's a good number of us. Even though we're not a lot, it's a little community that I have, as well as families who've lived here from Vanuatu. They live in Auckland. They're able to, like, reach out to us, and we find that community in them as well.
And, you know, let's talk about the theme itself. Talk about climate change. It is real. We must look after life. That theme itself, what does that mean to you?
To me, I used to be like a really, really big, like, environmental kind of freak, but I still have those values in me. The effects of climate change are real. Like, I see it every year, actually. We get changes in our crops. We have pests coming in, especially like rhino beetles, and our crops are, like, not really yielding the same as they used to, as well as the weather having the twin cyclones coming in, the frequency of cyclones happening more. It's having a lot of effect on the people because we don't make as much money. So when these disasters happen, it has an effect on the people, the economy. It's our livelihood. It's who we are.
Well, and let's talk about that, because I must say, and I'm sure you're aware of this, is that, you know, Vanuatu has recently celebrated such a historical victory in its global climate justice campaign.
Yeah.
Like, how important is that for yourself and for the people of your homeland to witness such a thing?
It's showing us that even though we're little, we have a voice, and the voice that we do have, it's really important to listen to, because we're a small country. Even though we're small, like, they can hear us, but we're going to be affected by it the most. So it's really nice to have our voice amplified out there so that people actually hear our cry and know about it.
This week, again, it coincides, I said it earlier, but that, you know, Vanuatu Independence Day was yesterday, 45 years. I mean, how did you celebrate, and how significant is that to you and to the people of Vanuatu?
Yesterday, I had lectures, but I know, well, I had a little pin I wore to school, and I was telling everyone, like, okay, everybody, it's Independence Day today, we're 45 years. It was really nice. Got to spend some time with my friends, other Vanuatu people here. So we got a lot of other people from other cultures and country to come together to celebrate our Independence Day as well. Some of my friends, they do feel homesick because they're not in Vanuatu to celebrate it. Celebrating it together, it was really good. It's like home away from home.
Yeah, so Claire, what's one thing, though, that you'd like people to know about Vanuatu?
One thing I want them to know is that we are very resilient. And despite all the challenges we have with political instability, we're still very resilient people.
And that is proud Ngāi Vanuatu citizen Claire Samuel, ending that story by Eggy Tupo.
Want to catch up or listen again to your favourite ABC Radio Australia programs anytime, anywhere? From Pacific Beat to Stories from the Pacific, Nisian Footy to Culture Compass. You can listen to your top shows on your favourite podcast app on the go and for free. Just search for your favourite ABC Radio Australia program in your podcast app and press play. ABC Radio Australia, bringing you more ways to listen.
And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Recapping our top story, Fiji High Court has found 9 men guilty of various charges stemming from the country's biggest drug bust.
The case exposed serious vulnerabilities in Fiji's border control and cited alarming evidence of complicity from officers within the Narcotics Bureau.
ABC's Lide Movuno there. We'll be back at the same time Monday. That's at 6 a.m. PNG time. You can hear us also this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because news is next, and coming up after is Nisha Daily. I'm Belinda Cora. Have a great day.
Centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories that connect us across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that continues that tradition, bringing you deep and personal stories from a diverse range of people. Athletes, farmers, artists, teachers, activists, entrepreneurs, all united by their Pacific heritage and incredible journeys.
Listen to Stories from the Pacific on your favorite podcast app.